Gilbertson presiding is now in session.
Please be seated. The first case for oral argument this morning is James Sealer and Kimberly Sealer appellants versus Great West Casualty Company and Berkeley Regional and this morning we have for the appellants we have Mr. Matthew Kenny, an attorney from Spearfish, and Mr. John Burke, a attorney from Rapid City, and Mr. Burke, you'll be presenting this morning?
Yes, sir.
All right, and for the Appley Berkeley Insurance, we have Mr. Michael Schaefer, and we have for Great West, Mr. Robert Anderson, attorney from here, and Mr. Schaefer hails from Sioux Falls. I understand, Mr. Anderson, you'll be going first and speaking for 10 minutes?
Yes, Your Honor, we'll split the time equally.
All right, and then Mr. Schaefer, you'll do the last 10. All right. Very well. And then, Mr. Burke, you'll do the rebuttal?
Yes, sir.
All right. Very well. Justice Wilbur has disqualified herself on this case. And I guess as a little procedural history, it actually became part of the court's docket before the first of the year. Therefore, Justice Konenkamp was still a justice at that time. And we are pleased he has returned to sit with us. And to replace Justice Wilbur, we have now Justice Konenkamp's replacement, Justice Kern. So that's how we get to where we're at. So with that, Mr. Burke, you have 20 minutes, sir. You may proceed.
Honorable Chief Justice Gilbertson, members of the court, Mr. Schaefer and Mr. Anderson, I want to begin by stating it is my honor to be able to appear before you today on behalf of Jim and Kimberly Sealer. The reason we are here today, because this case procedurally and policy-wise is complicated, I've tried to sort of summarize it to give us a better sense of what we're really trying to get to the bottom of today, and it is this. Whether a self-propelled sprayer being driven down the road that possesses many of the attributes of any highway vehicle, en route to a commercial spraying job, whether that vehicle is an auto or whether it's considered mobile equipment, keeping in mind that the commercial general liability policy and the commercial auto policy in this case use nearly mirror language so that they dovetail into one another to provide complete coverage. As a general rule, mobile equipment is excluded from a commercial auto policy and autos are excluded from a CGL. And so that's really what we're getting to the bottom of today.
As a procedural matter, I assume that it appears to me anyway that we are just trying to interpret some insurance policies. There's no question of facts, so we're basically discussing questions of law.
I think that's a fair assessment, Your Honor.
All right, thank you.
You know, you said that these have mirror provisions. Is it your position that both insurers can be liable in this case?
I think, Your Honor, I suspect that it's most likely that it's either one or the other, but that it has to be one or the other. In other words, I think it would be extremely difficult to find both, but equally difficult to find none.
Okay, well, which one, from your client's perspective, is primarily the suspect?
Great West, Your Honor. If this is an auto that falls under the commercial auto policy of Great West Casualty and is not excluded under their language. The reason why, and I'm going to get to that, Your Honor, is a little bit later, is if this court concludes otherwise, then it forces it to fall under the CGL from Berkeley. But the Sealer's position is that this is actually defined and the use of it is falling under an auto that would be covered by the commercial auto policy of Great West. Briefly, in terms of background and how we got here, on July 11th of 2010, Jim and Kimberly Sealer went for a motorcycle ride. They proceeded south out of Huron on a four-lane highway that we're probably all familiar with. And minutes into their ride, a 4720 John Deere self-propelled sprayer came off of a gravel road on their right, pulled in front of them, and resulted in the collision that we have today. Given the nature of what this coverage dispute is about in terms of is this an auto, is it mobile equipment, the attributes of that item of equipment are actually relevant. This John Deere 4720 self-propelled sprayer, I alluded to in my opening remarks that it had many of the attributes of any other highway vehicle. For example, it has headlights, taillights, turn signals, four-way flashers, side-view mirrors, a horn, a seatbelt, windshield wipers, a heater, an air conditioner, a radio. It could travel up to at least 29 miles per hour and had no difficulty simply proceeding down the road. So that describes the vehicle. It's also a bit relevant how it came to be that Troy Dowling, who was the operator of the sprayer, how it came to be that he was using a sprayer that he did not own. The 4720 was actually owned by relatives of his, some uncles that owned a partnership called the Dowling Brothers Partnership. And basically the reason he was there that day with someone else's sprayer is this. He does farm work and commercial spraying East River, and he has family that has a large farming operation down by Draper. As part of their contributing to the family operation, he would periodically bring his sprayer, because Troy Dowling owned his own 4830, West River, and help out spraying. It turned out that when he needed to go back home and do some spraying, that the tires on one of his relative sprayers, this 4720, were better suited for the work he was going to be doing, so they swapped sprayers for a temporary period. Mr. Dowling left his sprayer out in the Draper area, and then he hauled this 4720 back to his area. On the morning of the accident, he was essentially on his way to do a commercial spraying job. He did not have the booms out, was not applying chemical or anything like that. He was simply driving and proceeded out into Highway 37, the four-lane road. And I think it's worth noting that he wasn't simply crossing the road, in other words, where he was going to be simply zipping across the highway and then back on side roads. His plan that morning was actually turn north on Highway 37 and travel, I think, close to a mile driving down a four-lane highway with this vehicle. At the time of the collision, Troy Dowling himself had a commercial auto policy in place with Great West, and he had a CGL in place with Berkeley. Now, there was a separate policy that covered the sprayer because it was owned by the uncles. That, as you know, this court dealt with separately in the appeal that was previously decided. So really, the only carriers we're talking about today are Dowling, the operator's personal carriers, the CGL and the commercial auto. Procedurally, briefly, the action started out as this. Berkeley, the CGL, brought a declaratory judgment action naming the other carriers, the Seilers, Dowlings, as parties, asking for a determination that under an auto exclusion in the CGL policy, that there's no coverage for this sprayer. Berkeley later moved for summary judgment. The trial court granted that motion, ruling that, in its opinion, this sprayer is required to be licensed and therefore insured under South Dakota law. Therefore, it falls under the definition of an auto, and the CGL would not have coverage.
So does this case or both cases hinge on the question of whether or not can the compulsory licensing laws apply?
In one aspect, yes, but there are other ways that there are coverage, even if the licensure issue was not in play.
Because the trial court made... With respect to the Berkeley policy, the trial court said that the compulsory laws apply. And then with respect to the Great West policy, the court said it didn't apply. How do we reconcile that?
I can't, Your Honor, and it's part of the reason I think we're here today. I think it's worth noting that part of the reason I think that happened is this. If you look closely at Judge Erickson's, I'll answer your question by the next step in procedure. Berkeley gets out. On the basis of licensure and insurance requirements. Right. Great West moved for summary judgment, and the court reiterated, I think this thing needs to be licensed and insured under South Dakota law. Then there was a court trial on Farm Bureau, which is the other appeal, and Great West. After the trial court ruled that Great West was out, but he did not get into the licensure and insurance issues. He actually used two different reasons that have nothing to do with the insurance. He said, looking to the definition of a motor vehicle in an MCS 90 endorsement, I don't think this is a motor vehicle. And he also said it doesn't fit within the business scheme of Great West, which obviously we take exception to because we say the contract controls.
But there are findings where he says that the financial responsibility law doesn't apply to the vehicle.
Yes.
In the Great West case, but does apply to the vehicle in the Berkeley case.
Yes. And what happened was when Great West did its proposed findings, they included additional reasoning, if you will, for why there should not be coverage under their policy. They added, I believe, three different, what I'll call additional reasons. A, that it was not subject to compulsory financial responsibility. B, that
That was in the proposed findings that,
yes.
that Great West submitted, that the trial court didn't actually make, didn't actually do any finding on that until the proposed findings were accepted.
That's 100% correct. Okay. That was three things were proposed. That it's A, does not need to be required to be insured. B, that it is farm equipment as that is used, or farm machinery as that is used in their policy, and that it's excluded under an operations exclusion, which was key for Great West because under their operations exclusion, it does not matter if it needs to be licensed. And that sort of comes through in the argument we're going to talk about today. So they were proposed, and the court entered, signed those, and so we have, in other words, the original reasoning by the trial court is actually not the main arguments being advanced by Great West today. It's those additional ones. But that's how that happened. And the reason it was troubling, I guess, from our perspective is the court had said twice, this thing is required to be licensed and insured, and then signed findings saying the exact opposite within the same case, and it's the same language. It's defined similarly in these mirror policies.
Let me go into another thing here before your time expires. How do we, the court made this finding you just alluded to, that it doesn't fit within their scheme, their business scheme. How does the court rationalize accepting oral testimony about the contract? Was there some concern that there was ambiguity in the contract? Was that the loophole the court used to get to the admitting this testimony and considering it?
Your Honor, I'm not entirely sure why the court elected to jump into fit within the scheme. If you read the court's original opinion, it simply says, it doesn't fall within their scheme, but the court did not first make a determination of ambiguity to sort of get there. In other words, had the court said, I find this ambiguous, therefore I'm going to go the route of the intent of Great West of what their scheme is, that's essentially what I think Great West is trying to argue here today. The problem that they're running into, though, and I think this brings a wall to that argument, is if the court had made the determination that it was ambiguous, then the insured, Dowling, gets the benefit of that ambiguity. You don't shift to intent in what Mrs. Hansen said from Great West. So in other words, if the court makes the jump to ambiguity, and I'm not really sure what this means, The trial court's fallback shouldn't be to go, well, Great West, just tell us what you meant. It should be, well, wait a minute. If it's ambiguous, benefit goes to the insurer.
Did you object to this testimony?
There was a motion in limine specifically saying that nobody from the carrier should be able to offer their interpretation or their intention or their expert opinion as to what the policies mean. There were also objections that Mr. Kinney made during the trial arguing that this is not how this is determined. But the motion in limine at the front end, there was actually a motion in limine with a number of cases listed saying the carriers can't bring their own people to get up and say what they think it means.
And the court made a definitive ruling on that motion?
Essentially, Your Honor, if you read the pretrial comments before the trial, it was essentially agreed to, it seemed, by all counsel that, yeah, nobody's really going to do that. But then Great West representative, I'll say, sort of wandered into... she probably wouldn't call it her expert testimony. I think she would say, this isn't what we normally do, which is a little bit different.
Let me go back to just before I know I'm dominating the time here, but I have one more question. As to this question of the compulsory financial law, was that an issue that was disputed during the trial, or was there a stipulation, or was it simply assumed that the financial responsibility law did apply to the sprayer?
That's a very good question, Your Honor. At the summary judgment phase, when Berkeley moved for summary judgment, it attached It did a statement of fact in its proposed undisputed statement of material fact, saying under South Dakota's DOT handbook, because this is a commercial sprayer being used for a commercial entity, it's required to be licensed. The Silers did not dispute that because the Silers take the position that it's an auto. Great West did not dispute that at the summary judgment phase either. I would say, in fairness, I don't think that Great West agrees that it is required to be licensed. What they have done is they're essentially saying, and if you look at their briefs, Your Honor, they're saying it's immaterial to us because if you go to our exclusion, we think we can exclude this sprayer from our coverage under an operations exclusion, even if it's required to be licensed or not. That's essentially where they put all their eggs, so to speak.
Thank you.
So shifting back a little bit to, I guess, the arguments that are coming through from Great West, they are these. If you walk through the policy, we've touched a little bit on the operations exclusion, but why we're saying this is an auto that should be covered under a commercial auto policy is if you look at how auto is defined in the Berkeley policy, and that's something that I think this court maybe needs to sort of keep in the back of their mind. While we, as a person out in our everyday lives may think, is a commercial sprayer, does that seem like an auto? We have to keep in mind that it's really not how we feel or what we might call it in everyday conversation. It's how the carriers defined it. So while we may think that seems an odd thing to call an auto or mobile equipment, we got to go back to the definitions. And if you look at the definition of auto, and this is in both policies, it's a land motor vehicle, trailer, or semi-trailer designed for travel on a public road. Clearly, this is a land motor vehicle designed for travel on public road. Number two, it also includes anything that's required to be subject to financial responsibility laws, and that makes it an auto. We have argued that the trial court erred when it stepped outside of the policy and went to an MCS 90 endorsement, which I will try not to get too far into those, but essentially the MCS 90 endorsements are added to policies to make sure that people that do over-the-road trucking, because Mr. Dowling had a tractor trailer. If you're in interstate commerce, Congress wanted to make sure that there's going to be coverage in place for interstate commerce activities. The judge took the definition of motor vehicle from that endorsement and supplanted it into the policy, essentially, to say, I don't think this is a motor vehicle. The court was wrong for a couple reasons. First, if you look closely at the language of the MCS 90 endorsement, it makes clear that it's not supposed to modify or overwrite the policy it's attached to, much less to defeat coverage as it's being used here, when in fact an MCS 90 endorsement is meant to ensure coverage. There's no question under subpart 1 or subpart 2 that it's an automobile. So that shifts you to what I'll call the second argument that we made, which is this is not mobile equipment as defined in either of the policies. So the argument gets a little bit tricky here because what Great West has essentially done is they are saying that under the first definition of mobile equipment, this is farm machinery, and they want this court to not look at a couple things within that same provision. The final catch-all, I'll call it, or a preemptive provision in the definition of mobile equipment. So if you're trying to decide if something's mobile equipment or not, you go down to the very bottom, and one thing that overrides all of it is farm machinery or otherwise. However, mobile equipment does not include land vehicles that are subject to a compulsory or financial responsibility law, blah, 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 blah. Okay? So once, if this court determines that this thing is subject to financial responsibility laws, that overwrites and it clearly can't be mobile equipment. That would end the discussion.
What standards do we use to decide that this is subject to compulsory financial responsibility law?
In Your Honor, I laid out in our brief, I walked through the steps that, in other words, if one were to set aside the DOT manual and not use it as, governing what this court would have to do, the way I walked through it is I looked at what vehicles are subject to financial responsibility. 32-35-2. Refers to vehicles subject to registration. So then I looked at what vehicles are subject to registration, and that included motor vehicles operated on public highways. So then I went, what's the definition of motor vehicle? 32-5-1. The only exemption is farm vehicles. But if you look at the farm vehicles exempted, this sprayer would not fall within any of those. That's how I walked through the process to figure this out. The final argument that I feel I should touch on is essentially where Great West is putting its meat of its argument, so to speak, now, is they're hanging their hat on an operations exclusion. And the reason they're doing that is they recognize that they're in a tough spot on the financial responsibility argument. The reason they like the operations exclusion is it basically says, if this thing would be mobile equipment, you know, setting aside whether it's required to be insured, if it falls within the definition of mobile equipment, then it's excluded for operations or injuries arising out of the operations. And this is in paragraph 9, operations. The problem is this. For this court to allow Great West to use that exclusion, you run into a couple problems. First of all, it excludes injury for damages for injury arising out of the operation of machinery equipment that is on, attached to, or part of the land vehicle. So not just the operation of the vehicle. It would be, for example, if the booms were sticking out and they did something in that the actual use of the boom as opposed to the operation of the vehicle. Great West has to somehow convince this court that the simple operation of the sprayer, which is all he was doing at that time, is operation of equipment on, attached to, or part of the land vehicle. The bigger problem they run into, though, is they say, listen, this thing is farm machinery. The problem with that is if they don't define farm machinery in the policy. So what Great West has done is they've looked at some online definitions and basically added farm and machinery together to come up with a definition they like. We went to the administrative rules of South Dakota, which defines farm machinery, and oddly enough, farm machinery leaves out anything required to be licensed in the state of South Dakota. So while Great West says it's immaterial, in the end, that would dictate whether or not something is farm machinery.
Thank you. Time has expired.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Anderson, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and if it pleases you and the court and counsel. I'm Rob Anderson. I'm here for Great West Casualty. I have a number of points specific I want to address, but first I'd also like to talk about a little bit about the background here and some of the arguments made by the other parties in their briefs. As you know now, Berkeley is here based on an appeal from a summary judgment which dismissed them from this action. Great West is here after a trial before fact and conclusions of law were entered. I do not agree that these Berkeley and Great West policies are mere policies to the extent that if you find liability or coverage under one, you can't find coverage under the other. I don't agree that this court could not find a lack of coverage on both policies. I think you could, and that may well be the most likely result and the result that's supported by the facts and the evidence and the law. You could also probably find coverage on both policies. But the arguments that are made that, well, this sprayer is an auto and it's logical that the risk should be covered by a commercial auto policy, that argument was made by both parties. It was made by Berkeley on page 24 of their brief saying the risk for insuring this sprayer belongs to a CGL or commercial liability policy. But on the same day the accident occurred, Troy Dowling owned a virtually identical sprayer, which was, in fact, not covered by the Great West commercial auto policy, but covered by the Berkeley policy. About 2 weeks after this accident occurred, this very sprayer was covered by the Berkeley policy, not by the Great West policy. That kind of ties into the questions about why did we have this testimony at trial concerning what I think the circuit court referred to it as the business plan was of Great West or Farm Bureau. There were testimony from both Farm Bureau and Great West personnel at the trial. Well, the reason wasn't to explain or tell the court how to interpret the policy. I don't believe any Great West witness did that. I don't think Mr. Burke acknowledged that. Farm Bureau may have gone a little far, and if you read the transcript, you'll see many objections were sustained to that testimony. But Great West testimony was, we don't insure farm machinery. This is farm machinery. That was found both in a finding of fact and conclusion of law by the trial court, and it was found appropriately. No.
The court also made the finding, though, that it doesn't fit within the business scheme. How does that comport with the contract?
I think it would if there had been a finding of ambiguity. There was no finding by anybody that an ambiguity existed.
Okay.
Yes, that's correct. Now, if we, another analogy to use in looking at this, in addition to acknowledging that these sprayers are in fact covered by CGL policies, I think normally, not by auto policies, is to look at what would happen if we had an auto case here. None of us would be here because the law is well settled. The owner and the policy of insurance that the owner carries on an auto when he loans it to someone else, that's going to be the primary coverage. This court looked at Farm Bureau, who insured the owner of this sprayer, and made a neutral analysis of the terms and conditions of the Farm Bureau policy and found that no coverage existed. I think, and I would suggest, that when the same type of analysis is made here, a determination should be made consistent with that of the circuit court that there's no coverage on the part of the Great West policy.
Let me ask you the same question I asked counsel earlier. Does your case hinge on the question whether financial responsibility law applies?
No, because even there's multiple levels of analysis here. And before I answer that, well, I'll answer that question. It's no. The court is in a position that's not usually in insurance coverage cases here, because usually we could all find about 50 cases that support our interpretation of a particular policy provision, whether it be exclusion or coverage language. There's one case that interprets the mobile equipment exclusion that's pretty much directly on point. There are other cases that we have all cited that maybe give guidance, but there are virtually no cases nationwide discussing the very issue that's before the court today. So we're a little in the dark on that. The reason the answer is no is that even if the sprayer is mobile equipment under the definition of the statute, but it's still an auto because it is subject to compulsory financial responsibility laws, then it could and would, in our opinion and in the opinion of the circuit court, still be excluded under the operations exclusion. The operations exclusion basically says, hey, if there's a, let's say, a piece of farm machinery, such as this is, that is covered under the coverage portion of the policy only because it is subject and it's not mobile equipment only because it is subject to compulsory financial responsibility law, then we're still not going to cover it. That's the operations exclusion, and I think you have to go through this multiple level of analysis.
So does it depend on really on how broadly we read that operations exclusion as to whether we're saying that the operation of the entire physical machine caused the accident or simply the operation of the sprayer itself caused the accident? Is that
in part. You know, if you're interpreting the operations exclusion, that's a significant issue to look at. I agree. Mm-hmm. Stepping back and again addressing the question of what standard do we use to determine whether this sprayer is subject to financial responsibility law? Mr. Burke's interpretation of, I think the answer is you go to the statute. You don't go to a bulletin that our Department of Revenue issues. They'd never be overreaching. We all know that. You look at the statute that authorizes all these things, and the statute says we exclude, I'm paraphrasing because I don't have it in front of me, we exclude farm equipment used for the cultivation, tillage, or harvesting of crops. To say that applying herbicide, pesticide, fertilizer is not part of the cultivation of crops, cultivation isn't simply breaking up earth. Cultivation is part and parcel of the agricultural process and the growing and nurturing.
Was that a disputed issue at trial?
I don't know that it was ever discussed at trial.
Because it looks to me like the trial court didn't get much guidance from either side on that question. It seemed like it was kind of understood that it was covered by.
I don't know if it's fair to say that it was understood. I think you're accurate in saying there wasn't much discussion of it at trial. I think that's true.
And what about the undisputed statement of fact on that issue?
That was a statement of fact, and I think the circuit court made findings of fact and conclusions of law that in support of Great West Casualty that in order to reverse, this court has to find are clearly erroneous. If you're asking, does that bind the court later? The court obviously felt that it did not, and I would agree. As it relates to Great West Casualty, this is the posture of this case procedurally is a little bit unique, and it kind of creates some problems that way. I think that in terms of the argument that this sprayer was not mobile equipment, that's easily dispelled, and that in fact is the only case that we really have on point, and that's that American Star Insurance case. I agree with Mr. Burke. We are not ignoring and never have ignored the last paragraph of the mobile equipment definition, which says at the end, however, all this equipment that we've identified as mobile equipment is still an auto if it's subject to the compulsory financial responsibility requirements. So the analysis is it an auto, is it mobile equipment? If it's mobile equipment, it is not, it's excluded from the definition of an auto. But if it's mobile equipment and it's subject to compulsory financial responsibility requirements, then there's another step in the analysis, and that's to go to the operations exclusion. And the operations exclusion, I would submit, is designed to do exactly that for a company that doesn't insure farm equipment under commercial auto policies. And that is, and it wouldn't under the terms and conditions of this policy. I agree with what I'm sure both Mr. Schaefer and what Mr. Burke has already said, and I'm sure Mr. Schaefer will say, these cases should be determined according to the terms and conditions of the policy provisions of the three companies. They need to be analyzed separately and should be, just as you analyze the Farm Bureau policy separately. I don't believe there's any reason to look outside the scope of the policy since there's been no finding or really even argument of ambiguity here. But I do believe that there is a real issue about whether that compulsory financial responsibility requirement applied to the sprayer at the time. And even if it did, then you go to the exclusion and say, here's the exclusion. It's there for a reason. It excludes the operation of farm machinery that we otherwise would not cover.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson.
Thank you.
Mr. Schaefer, you have 10 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. It's my privilege to represent, I'll just refer to him as Berkeley in this case. This is a little bit of a unique posture. Berkeley started this declaratory judgment action, naming all of the parties to have the rights of the parties declared under the specific insurance policies that were potentially at issue here. Early on, after we did an initial discovery, we filed a motion for summary judgment, and included in that motion was our statement of material facts 12 and 13, where we specifically said that this sprayer was subject to, according to the Department of Transportation, titling and licensing requirements and also the registration requirements, making it subject to the financial responsibility laws. Troy Dowling did not dispute that fact. The Seilers did not dispute that fact. Great West did not dispute that fact. They disputed other facts, but that was an admitted fact at that stage of the proceedings. Judge Erickson granted our motion for summary judgment, holding, you know, essentially that we weren't obligated to defend or indemnify in this case, and essentially ruled that the financial responsibility laws applied to this commercial sprayer. When Great West filed its motion for summary judgment a year later, he ruled the same thing. Then they went to trial, and we weren't participating in the proceedings at that point, and we didn't attend the trial. And then I looked at the transcript of the trial. I don't think there was any discussion about the financial responsibility laws or whether this was required to be licensed, titled, or registered under South Dakota law. And the judge didn't say anything about it in the memorandum opinion he wrote. But then the attorney for Great West put all of those contrary findings in to support the decision.
So are you saying then that Great West is bound by the earlier statement?
Well, I'm saying I think with respect to our summary judgment, all of the parties are bound by that because they had a chance to dispute it, and they didn't. Okay. So if there's any issue about whether that fact is in dispute, it shouldn't be considered in dispute for purposes of the summary judgment that was granted to Berkeley. Now, really, you know, if you look at this policy, and you have to look at any, and I'm just going to refer to our policy, you have to look at the insuring provision, you have to look at the exclusions, and in this case, the exception to the exclusion. The insuring provision says that if there's insurance, if there's a bodily injury caused by an occurrence, which has happened here. The exclusion, however, says it contains an auto exclusion, which is what we're relying on here. It says that the occurrence which caused bodily injury involved the ownership, maintenance, or use of any auto owned, operated by, or rented, or loaned to any insured, it's excluded under the auto exclusion. Clearly, this vehicle is clearly a vehicle. It was loaned to Troy Dowling by his uncle. Therefore, it's excluded under the auto provision. Auto is defined essentially the same in both policies. In other words, a land motor vehicle designed for travel on public roads. It doesn't say, like in the Farm Bureau case, mainly on public roads. It's designed for travel on public roads, which this was. Or any other land vehicle that's subject to the compulsory financial responsibility laws of the state, which it was, according to the state of the record when we filed our motion for summary judgment, and that motion was granted. So on that state of the record, that order granting our motion, the court held that it was subject to the financial responsibility laws. The only things that aren't autos are mobile equipment, and then there's a laundry list of those. But there's an overall exception that anything that's subject to the financial responsibility laws is not mobile equipment but is considered to be an auto. Now, the guts of this case really boils down to, in our policy, the exception to the exclusion. The auto exclusion has an exception. It's kind of the mirror image of the Great West operations exclusion, but it says this exclusion does not apply, and it's on page 33 of our appendix. It says to bodily injury or property damage arising out of A, the operation of machinery or equipment that is attached to or part of a land vehicle that would be subject to the financial responsibility laws. In other words, if the bodily injury arises out of the operation of the equipment that's attached to the vehicle, in other words, the boom that's attached to the vehicle, it's covered under our policy, not the auto policy. And then the second subsection B says, the operation of any of the machinery or equipment included in paragraphs F2 or F3 of the definition of mobile equipment. Those are the provisions that talk about cherry pickers, air compressors, spraying equipment that's attached to the vehicle, the operation of the machinery or equipment. Those provisions, F2 and F3, don't even talk about a vehicle. They just talk about those pieces of equipment. Now, I don't agree with Mr. Anderson's, this American Star case, because I studied those. Those policies have different exclusions than what we have here, and I won't go into it. But there is a case that's directly on point, and that's the Rakestraw decision by the 11th Circuit. And there, that involved a vehicle that had an air compressor mounted to it. The guy was going to use the air compressor, and he was in an accident en route. The commercial liability, there was an attempt to, I think the auto policy paid, and they were trying to get recovery under the commercial liability policy. The district court said there isn't coverage, it's not ambiguous, we'll look at the policy. The 11th Circuit said the same thing. And what they said there is particularly pertinent here. They said, the district court correctly concluded that the exception to the auto exclusion applied to injury arising from the operation of the air compressor and not to injury arising from the operation of the self-propelled vehicle with permanently attached air compressor.
That's the central focus of the case, but I want to make sure I get one question in before you
yes.
run out of time. You know, I understand our constraints on considering evidence when we're construing a policy where that it's not ambiguous. But still, it's troubling to me that the sprayer was scheduled, or an identical sprayer was scheduled under your policy, and the record suggests that this exact sprayer got scheduled under your policy afterwards. It makes me think I'm missing something.
Well, I don't know why they tried to schedule it if they thought they could get after the fact coverage by putting it on there after the accident, or if it was damaged, or if he was going to continue to use it. I don't know this after the fact attempt to get it listed. But if you look at the policies, the Great West policy includes listed scheduled vehicles, and it also includes other vehicles that aren't scheduled, that are hired, borrowed, rented, whatever. When you look at these policies, you don't look at whether something is listed on the policy. You look at whether or not, under the definition of auto, it's covered under the auto policy and excluded under this policy. I mean, think about it. We live, particularly where I live, I see these vehicles, I see these fertilizer applicators and these pesticide applicators on the highways every day.
But why would it be scheduled if it's not covered?
It could be covered for other things. Like, for example, if this guy was using that to spray the road ditch and he's making a turn and then runs into the silers, that's probably going to be covered under that policy because it involves the operation of the equipment. You have to look, we can't change, because something's scheduled on one and not on another, you can't look at that. You have to look at what the definitions are, and you have to look at the language of the policy. Even that American Star case says you can't look at what somebody claimed they intended to cover under the policy. You have to look at what the policy language says. And here, the policy language in our, the only way they can get to us is under that exception to the exclusion. But that exception is for operation of the equipment attached to the vehicle. That's not what happened here. And that's not what happened in the Rakestraw case. And the 11th Circuit said, because Rakestraw's injuries arose from the use of an auto, they were excluded from coverage under the policy. Because the injuries did not arise from the operation of the air compressor, the exception to the auto exclusion did not apply. So that's what we're dealing with here.
Your time has expired. I'll let you read the quote.
Let me ask you another question, if I may. Okay. Well, it seems to me then that both of you, both Great West and Berkeley, are relying on the operations exclusion, although you're reading it differently.
No. The policy is set up under the Great West policy. They have an operations exclusion that says, essentially the mirror image of this, right, that it excludes things that relate to the operation of the equipment that's attached to it. In other words, they don't cover
right
the boom because it's an auto policy.
And yours does cover the operation of the attached equipment if the accident had occurred because the sprayer hit somebody in the head.
Right, that's right.
That does cover it.
So yes.
You're basically using the same language.
It's kind of the flip of the other.
Right.
Right. Okay. But so one covers and one doesn't, and I don't. Okay,
so doesn't that follow then that one policy cannot cover this and one policy must cover?
I agree with that.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Schaefer and Mr. Burke. You have 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Before jumping back to Great West Counsel's comments, I want to follow up on the court's question. Because I do think that Great West has tried to argue, they referred to it as a hodgepodge of policies that existed. Justice Konenkamp, your question was spot on and Mr. Schaefer's answer is correct. The language, if you look at just two provisions in this case, if you look at the operations exclusion in the Great West policy and compare it to the exception to the auto exclusion in the CGL, you will find that it's almost to the comma identical. That's really, these are made to mirror one another, and that it can't walk between the raindrops. It's going to fall into one or the other, but I don't think it's appropriate for the carriers to Great West wants to come up and call it farm machinery, and then Berkeley takes the other position, and somehow with identical language, one being an exclusion, one bringing it into coverage in the CGL, they're saying, well, it's not us. It must be one or the other.
Well, it comes down to a fact question of whether they were operating the equipment or whether they were operating the vehicle.
In one sense, yes. Nobody's argued that it's not disputed that the booms weren't out and that he was not applying chemical. He was simply driving down the road, and I don't think any attorney or any party would challenge that. It's being driven like a vehicle at the time of the collision. And that's what brings you back to the Rakestraw case and the National American case. They will oftentimes look, when you're getting into this narrow language about the exclusion in one and the exception to the exclusion in the other, what was being used at the time? Mr. Schaefer is correct. If you look at the Rakestraw case involving a cherry picker, they were actually, sorry, the air compressor on a vehicle. It was a permanently mounted air compressor on the back of a vehicle, and they said, this didn't happen because of anything to do with the permanently attached air compressor. He was simply driving it. The there's another Eighth Circuit case involving a grain truck, and it was interesting that the Eighth Circuit commented, because I think one of the parties tried to argue, well, the grain truck typically just hauls it from the field to somewhere, so it's really just farm machinery. And the Eighth Circuit said, quote, the use of the vehicle at the time of the collision, hauling grain on a public road leading to a grain elevator, is strong evidence demonstrating the vehicle was being used as an auto and not farm machinery. And so they actually do look at what the vehicle is doing at the time. To come back to a few of the arguments that Mr. Anderson advanced on behalf of Great West, I want to talk a little bit about the farm machinery argument, that this is something that should be considered farm machinery. First of all, the statute, the exemption, Mr. Anderson used the word cultivating, but the exemption statute for what needs to be registered does not use the word cultivating in it. It actually refers to it as tillage, harvesting, or transportation. Cultivation to me seems a bit more broadly. And frankly, I don't think Great West gets to come in after the fact in a policy where they went down to defining such a specific term as what is a trailer, for them to not define farm machinery now and then say, well, let's just go look at these two words and what we can find on the internet. They never responded to our point in our brief that the administrative rules of South Dakota define farm machinery as a vehicle that it would be taking out of that definition if it's required to be licensed.
But
they don't respond.
American Star would support their position.
I disagree, Your Honor. The American Star case is problematic for a few reasons. First of all, they do not have the catch-all that we have in ours. At the bottom of the definition of mobile equipment, we have the preemptive clause that says, hey, if this thing's required to be licensed.
Well, but that's another issue. That's a separate issue.
And if the court's going toward use, in that case it was stipulated that the truck was normally used off-road and not licensed for road use, if you look at that. Also, their F2 and F3 exclusion is less broad than this court's. I don't think National American determines it the way that they're saying that it should. I don't think it supports them when you have different language, missing the preemptive clause, and the parties are stipulating that it doesn't need to be licensed.
Wait a minute now. The parties are stipulating? They stipulated in that case that there was...
In that case.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, sure. Justice Koniskamp, you said in large part this case may come down to how broadly we read the operations exclusion. That's exactly correct. If you take Berkeley's definition, they want the simple operation of the sprayer, the driving of it, to be the operation of equipment on, attached to, or part of. In other words, they say it doesn't matter if the booms are being used and you're actually spraying or not. if you are simply driving that equipment, that's equipment attached to, part of, or on the equipment. Their definition of farm machinery, I think to just simply stop at farm machinery and say, well, that ends the discussion, is not sufficient. If you go to their definition of mobile equipment, there's not only the preemptive clause at the bottom that says, hey, if it's licensed, it takes it out of there. We'll set that aside for a minute. But this court has said repeatedly from Hansen on forward that you need to look at a policy as a whole. And so when I'm looking at the mobile equipment definition, I do see the first one would include farm machinery. But I think the policy tells us, if we want to read it together, I think it cannot be lost that paragraph 6 of the mobile equipment definition says, vehicles not described in paragraph 1, 2, or 3, or 4 above, maintained primarily for purposes other than the transportation of persons or cargo. And this is how specific they were. However, self-propelled vehicles with the following types of permanently attached equipment are not mobile equipment, but will be considered autos. Subpart C has spraying. And so I think when you're trying to look at what was intended in the contract by the definition of farm machinery, I think it's relevant that five paragraphs down, they say, keep in mind here, if it doesn't fall within one of these, if it's a self-propelled vehicle with spraying equipment, which is exactly what we have here, that's going to be considered an auto. That's Great West's own language. The policies are intended, and Berkeley did a good job of pointing this out in its brief. The policies, a CGL and a commercial auto policy, are intentionally written so that they interlock together, so that they dovetail and create a unified whole. The notion that you can sort of fall between the cracks should not and cannot happen when you use provisions that interlock. It either falls into one or it falls into the other. I have a concern about Great West wanting to point out what happened after the fact in terms of, did someone try to add the 4720 to a policy, or was it listed under a given policy? We have to keep in mind this was a permissive use of a vehicle, so it wasn't going to be listed at the time of the accident anyway. And how an agent may have set something up with a specific carrier should not determine what the definitions are within the policies. If you look at the language within the definitions of the policies, and look at what's excluded and what's not, this vehicle being driven to a commercial spraying job, not using the spraying equipment that was on, attached to, or part of it, but simply driving it, a self-propelled vehicle with spraying equipment, falls under the definition and ultimately becomes an insured event under the commercial auto policy. I struggle with the notion that I guess for Great West to convince this court that there's no coverage, it actually has to get this court to two different steps. In the end, if we want to cut to the chase, for Great West to dodge coverage, they have to convince you of two things. First of all, they have to convince you that though they didn't define it, though the administrative rules would call this farm machinery, and though it was required to be licensed, and though it was a self-propelled equipment with spraying equipment attached, that this is farm machinery. That's the first thing they would have to do to fall under the operations exclusion. The second thing they would have to do is they would have to convince you that the simple driving of the sprayer is actually the operation of the equipment attached to it, part of, or made of it. So in other words, you have to abandon rake straw, step aside from the grain truck case and say simply, in other words, the operation of the equipment, even though the air compressor is separate, that somehow that's driving the vehicle. They have to get you to those two levels to avoid coverage under the operations exclusion. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Burke. The court will be in recess for 10 minutes.